This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, June 2021 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. Which activity is new at the adventure camp this year? B. What accommodation would the students like to stay in?
Are you going to adventure camp this summer?
Yeah, it's going to be even better than usual this year because they're introducing new activities. I heard there's going to be a climbing wall.
There's always been one. You must have missed it. You normally spend most of the time swimming at the river. But cycling has finally made it onto the activity list.
Great.
I guess we're staying in tents again. I'd rather camp than sleep in those old apartments we used to share.
So you haven't heard about the wooden huts? They've just finished building them. They sound really cool. Let's hope we get one of those.
Yeah. Are you going to adventure camp this summer?
Yeah, it's going to be even better than usual this year because they're introducing new activities. I heard there's going to be a climbing wall.
There's always been one. You must have missed it. You normally spend most of the time swimming at the river. But cycling has finally made it onto the activity list.
Great.
I guess we're staying in tents again. I'd rather camp than sleep in those old apartments we used to share.
So you haven't heard about the wooden huts? They've just finished building them. They sound really cool. Let's hope we get one of those.
Yeah.
Question 2. A. Where did the girl volunteer last spring? B. What skills did the girl find most difficult to learn?
Have you ever done any volunteering?
Yeah, last springtime during the college holidays. I was hoping to get some work experience at the Science Museum. That didn't happen and I ended up at the amusement park. I wasn't convinced I'd enjoy it, but I didn't have to stand outside operating the rides. I did admin work.
Was it worth doing? Did you improve your communication skills, that kind of thing?
Well, some tasks were straightforward, like data entry work. Answering the phone was important, and I picked up some good skills in that area, though I struggled at first. I did some emailing too, which was fine.
Great. Have you ever done any volunteering?
Yeah, last springtime during the college holidays. I was hoping to get some work experience at the Science Museum. That didn't happen and I ended up at the amusement park. I wasn't convinced I'd enjoy it, but I didn't have to stand outside operating the rides. I did admin work.
Was it worth doing? Did you improve your communication skills, that kind of thing?
Well, some tasks were straightforward, like data entry work. Answering the phone was important, and I picked up some good skills in that area, though I struggled at first. I did some emailing too, which was fine.
Great.
Question 3. A. What must the friends be on time for? B. What does the boy think he has left in the changing room?
Hey, it's me. I've finished my football match and I'm waiting for you outside the sports centre. Have you had your tennis lesson? We'll have to set off in a couple of minutes. The guys will be really annoyed if we're late for band practice again. Actually, if you're still in the changing room, can you have a look around for my name badge? It's the one I use for my supermarket job. Last week I thought I'd lost my wallet. Luckily someone handed it in. Anyway, I'm talking too much. Call me back. Hey, it's me. I've finished my football match and I'm waiting for you outside the sports centre. Have you had your tennis lesson? We'll have to set off in a couple of minutes. The guys will be really annoyed if we're late for band practice again. Actually, if you're still in the changing room, can you have a look around for my name badge? It's the one I use for my supermarket job. Last week I thought I'd lost my wallet. Luckily someone handed it in. Anyway, I'm talking too much. Call me back.
Question 4. A. What must all food stalls use at the music festival? B. Where will the festival be held this year?
Come to our music festival. There's something for everyone, from kids' activities to brilliant musical performances. Back by popular demand is our play area, with swings, slides, and rides for little ones and grown-ups alike. The food stalls are back again, with a wider choice than ever, from award-winning pizza to delicious ice cream, all produced from local ingredients. Our new rule about this has definitely paid off. It's helped our farmers, and there'll be some delicious treats to try. Don't forget that Cherry Park is the location. Our previous venue, the River Club, won't be able to hold the number of visitors we're expecting this year. Around 5,000. Come to our music festival. There's something for everyone, from kids' activities to brilliant musical performances. Back by popular demand is our play area, with swings, slides, and rides for little ones and grown-ups alike. The food stalls are back again, with a wider choice than ever, from award-winning pizza to delicious ice cream, all produced from local ingredients. Our new rule about this has definitely paid off. It's helped our farmers, and there'll be some delicious treats to try. Don't forget that Cherry Park is the location. Our previous venue, the River Club, won't be able to hold the number of visitors we're expecting this year. Around 5,000.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a talk about an animal called the spotted hyena. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Today I'm going to talk about a very interesting species, spotted hyenas. Spotted hyenas live throughout the African continent and are found in most habitats there, including grasslands, sub-deserts, and in mountains up to an altitude of around 13,000 feet, about 4,000 meters. Estimates of hyena numbers vary from a little less than 30,000 individuals to possibly up to about 50,000 living in their natural environment. Zoologists tend to study spotted hyenas because they're quite unlike other meat-eating animals in several ways. Hyenas live in large groups, and it's the females that dominate the group, whereas in many other species, it's the males. But zoologists say that it's the social behavior of hyenas above all that makes them such a fascinating species to study. Although they live in groups like wolves and African wild dogs, spotted hyena societies are actually more like those of some monkeys and apes. However, Hyenas are competitive when it comes to sharing meals, and rarely cooperative as far as things like looking after their young are concerned, which is rather different from monkeys and apes. Spotted hyenas are able to recognize each other, and they understand the differences in personality between each of the members of their group. Every animal has their own position within the social structure, and how high up they are depends not on how big or aggressive they are, but how reliable they are. In addition, the young of an important female automatically have a higher status than adult males. It's typical for females to live with their young in a family group, along with those they grew up with. But all hyena groups separate when they go hunting. Some choose to do this alone, whilst others team up. Dominant hyenas eat first, with the others waiting in line. The group later reunites to sleep. Males, on the other hand, often go off on their own when they reach the age of 2.5. Spotted hyenas are very territorial, which means that individual groups will defend the area where they live and patrol its borders. These are usually respected, and animals have been observed to suddenly stop chasing prey, like a deer or antelope, if it goes into another territory, unless there's a food shortage. An individual male in search of a mate is more likely to enter another territory than a female, though it takes a long time for him to be accepted. Other interesting behaviors include the way spotted hyenas clean themselves. Like cats, they lick their fur to get rid of dirt. They sit on the ground on their lower back and raise their legs to wash them. For some reason, however, they don't bother with their face, which is rather unusual. Spotted hyenas are very vocal, producing dog-like noises. The most recognizable hyena call is its distinctive laughing sound, made when an individual is excited or frustrated. Its pitch, how high or low it is, depends on the hyena's age, whereas variations in the frequency of notes used conveys information about the animal's position within the group.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Today I'm going to talk about a very interesting species, spotted hyenas. Spotted hyenas live throughout the African continent and are found in most habitats there, including grasslands, sub-deserts, and in mountains up to an altitude of around 13,000 feet, about 4,000 meters. Estimates of hyena numbers vary from a little less than 30,000 individuals to possibly up to about 50,000 living in their natural environment. Zoologists tend to study spotted hyenas because they're quite unlike other meat-eating animals in several ways. Hyenas live in large groups, and it's the females that dominate the group, whereas in many other species, it's the males. But zoologists say that it's the social behavior of hyenas above all that makes them such a fascinating species to study. Although they live in groups like wolves and African wild dogs, spotted hyena societies are actually more like those of some monkeys and apes. However, hyenas are competitive when it comes to sharing meals, and rarely cooperative as far as things like looking after their young are concerned, which is rather different from monkeys and apes. Spotted hyenas are able to recognize each other, and they understand the differences in personality between each of the members of their group. Every animal has their own position within the social structure, and how high up they are depends not on how big or aggressive they are, but how reliable they are. In addition, the young of an important female automatically have a higher status than adult males. It's typical for females to live with their young in a family group, along with those they grew up with. But all hyena groups separate when they go hunting. Some choose to do this alone, whilst others team up. Dominant hyenas eat first, with the others waiting in line. The group later reunites to sleep. Males, on the other hand, often go off on their own when they reach the age of 2.5. Spotted hyenas are very territorial, which means that individual groups will defend the area where they live and patrol its borders. These are usually respected, and animals have been observed to suddenly stop chasing prey, like a deer or antelope, if it goes into another territory, unless there's a food shortage. An individual male in search of a mate is more likely to enter another territory than a female, though it takes a long time for him to be accepted. Other interesting behaviors include the way spotted hyenas clean themselves. Like cats, they lick their fur to get rid of dirt. They sit on the ground on their lower back and raise their legs to wash them. For some reason, however, they don't bother with their face, which is rather unusual. Spotted hyenas are very vocal, producing dog-like noises. The most recognizable hyena call is its distinctive laughing sound, made when an individual is excited or frustrated. Its pitch, how high or low it is, depends on the hyena's age, whereas variations in the frequency of notes used conveys information about the animal's position within the group.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about doing a public speaking course. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list, A to G, which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
It's easy to criticise other people's speaking styles. They deliver a funny line in the wrong way so no one notices it, or they stick to one spot on the stage. When I saw a practice video of myself during a course about giving presentations, I realised that's exactly what I was like. I lacked facial expression and just stood there, barely moving. I sounded okay, but the overall effect was boring. I'm tons better at that now, and I don't just rely on my slides to get my message across.
Speaker 2.
They say that public speaking is a two-way communication, and it's vital to be aware of the people sitting in front of you listening carefully to your every word. Obviously, what you're saying is important, but the way you say it is important too. People will definitely switch off if you don't make eye contact and speak directly to them. You need to read people, know when they're interested or getting bored, and this is something I've got better at doing.
Speaker 3.
Until I did a speaking course that focused on things like breathing and relaxation, I had no idea how to stop negative feelings. I'd get into such an anxious state when I had to give a talk that I'd barely eat or sleep the day before. I'd try to focus on preparing what I'd say and how I'd say it so that my voice would remain steady once I stood up in front of people, but that never really worked. I'd also spend ages on my handouts, but now I'm not so bothered about that.
Speaker 4.
Varying your tone and projecting to the back of the room definitely helps with public speaking of any kind. I used to mumble and rush and sound stressed, even though I didn't feel it, but I've definitely overcome that now, after doing a few public speaking classes. Standing up and talking to a big bunch of people is never going to be my favourite thing, but knowing your subject inside out and presenting yourself in a way that makes you appear confident really helps. On-screen images are good for communicating ideas too.
Speaker 5.
Many people get nervous when they have to address an audience. That was never an issue for me. I didn't used to speak loudly enough, but doing presentations at work really helped with this. Anyway, then I did a training course. Much of it focused on making a talk worth listening to, so we spent time planning what information would go into the talk, and at what point to say it, and what could be left out. Being prepared in that way definitely helps a talk go more smoothly.
Speaker 6.
I have to give presentations for work, so I went on a public speaking course. In the first session, we had to prepare a short talk about a subject we were interested in and receive feedback from those who listened to it. That identified my strengths and weaknesses, some of which came as a surprise, like how quiet my voice was. But they were worth discovering, and I apply that knowledge to different things I do. I still feel anxious when I have to stand up and talk, though.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
It's easy to criticise other people's speaking styles. They deliver a funny line in the wrong way so no one notices it, or they stick to one spot on the stage. When I saw a practice video of myself during a course about giving presentations, I realised that's exactly what I was like. I lacked facial expression and just stood there, barely moving. I sounded okay, but the overall effect was boring. I'm tons better at that now, and I don't just rely on my slides to get my message across.
Speaker 2.
They say that public speaking is a two-way communication, and it's vital to be aware of the people sitting in front of you listening carefully to your every word. Obviously, what you're saying is important, but the way you say it is important too. People will definitely switch off if you don't make eye contact and speak directly to them. You need to read people, know when they're interested or getting bored, and this is something I've got better at doing.
Speaker 3.
Until I did a speaking course that focused on things like breathing and relaxation, I had no idea how to stop negative feelings. I'd get into such an anxious state when I had to give a talk that I'd barely eat or sleep the day before. I'd try to focus on preparing what I'd say and how I'd say it so that my voice would remain steady once I stood up in front of people, but that never really worked. I'd also spend ages on my handouts, but now I'm not so bothered about that.
Speaker 4.
Varying your tone and projecting to the back of the room definitely helps with public speaking of any kind. I used to mumble and rush and sound stressed, even though I didn't feel it. But I've definitely overcome that now, after doing a few public speaking classes. Standing up and talking to a big bunch of people is never going to be my favourite thing, but knowing your subject inside out and presenting yourself in a way that makes you appear confident really helps. On-screen images are good for communicating ideas too.
Speaker 5.
Many people get nervous when they have to address an audience. That was never an issue for me. I didn't used to speak loudly enough, but doing presentations at work really helped with this. Anyway, then I did a training course. Much of it focused on making a talk worth listening to, so we spent time planning what information would go into the talk, and at what point to say it, and what could be left out. Being prepared in that way definitely helps a talk go more smoothly.
Speaker 6.
I have to give presentations for work, so I went on a public speaking course. In the first session, we had to prepare a short talk about a subject we were interested in and receive feedback from those who listened to it. That identified my strengths and weaknesses, some of which came as a surprise, like how quiet my voice was. But they were worth discovering, and I apply that knowledge to different things I do. I still feel anxious when I have to stand up and talk, though.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with a motorbike racer called Matt about a series of road races called the TT races. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Matt, you've just returned from taking part in the TT motorbike races. These are races on roads, not a racetrack, right?
Right. The TT races take place on ordinary roads, closed to the public during the event, rather than a racetrack. The TT road course is particularly long, with tight corners and straight sections where you can reach speeds of over 300 kilometres an hour. You'd never do that on a racetrack. That's the attraction of road racing for me. It's a different technique too. You brake and lean differently.
The TT races are known as time trials. Can you explain that?
Each TT race has several laps and they're timed. A time trial's where, instead of all racers starting together, one sets off every 10 seconds. At the TT, there's an official practice session beforehand, and whoever's fastest during that sets off first in the actual race. That's never been me. That racer has a clear road ahead of them. But it's great to have other racers in sight. It pushes me and I do better in individual laps. Everyone completes the same number of laps, but you don't know how the fastest racers are doing because they're way ahead. You're just trying to get your best time.
And what's the difference between road motorbikes and racetrack motorbikes?
Racetrack motorbikes are superior. They're designed purely for racing and aren't available to buy. I'm unlikely to ever have a go on one. Anyone can get a road motorbike and adapt it for racing. Racetrack bikes feature sophisticated electronics and an impressive number of options for adjustments to the engine, and racers need to understand how to get the best from their bike. That takes practice. Road bikes are less complex, more straightforward to ride.
You operate as an individual, not as part of a team. How do you feel about that?
Well, whereas team racers are dependent on others to provide technical support, I have to know exactly what's going on with my bike. Some teams get tons of sponsorship, whereas individuals like me use their own resources. Entering the TT on your own doesn't come cheap, but that makes you committed to giving it your all.
But you've been part of a team in the past.
A couple. Though I wasn't a fan of switching between teams. It takes time to get the setup right. You form a close relationship with your team. You want to know each other well, and they need to know what you like about the bike so it can be built for you. You do that, then move and start again. I found that disrupted things, which can affect your chances of success.
Tell us about your mechanic.
That's my friend Phil. He's been helping me out for years, though he's shown little interest in getting on a bike himself. If I could pay him, I would. He'd certainly get a share of any winnings. I wouldn't go racing without him. He chases the dream with me, so any achievements are his too. Racers tend to get the credit when they win, but they couldn't do it without backup.
What's it like out on the TT course?
When you're familiarising yourself with the course before the races, you're memorising every bend, wall and building. By race day, you know every important detail. Races aren't the time to try new ways of doing things. When you're racing, you're not taking in the sights. The scenery is spectacular, apparently. At top speeds, you're dealing with wind resistance, bumps in the road. It's hardly a relaxing ride. Your focus is purely on what's coming next.
Have you been given lots of advice?
I used to hang about where teams were preparing bikes for races and find out what I could by asking them all kinds of stuff. There was this guy who'd give me tips. He wanted me to get things right. I learned to think things through thoroughly before acting, though I still get it wrong now and then. His advice has been invaluable.
Thanks, Matt.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Matt, you've just returned from taking part in the TT motorbike races. These are races on roads, not a racetrack, right?
Right. The TT races take place on ordinary roads, closed to the public during the event, rather than a racetrack. The TT road course is particularly long, with tight corners and straight sections where you can reach speeds of over 300 kilometres an hour. You'd never do that on a racetrack. That's the attraction of road racing for me. It's a different technique too. You brake and lean differently.
The TT races are known as time trials. Can you explain that?
Each TT race has several laps and they're timed. A time trial's where, instead of all racers starting together, one sets off every 10 seconds. At the TT, there's an official practice session beforehand and whoever's fastest during that sets off first in the actual race. That's never been me. That racer has a clear road ahead of them. But it's great to have other racers in sight. It pushes me and I do better in individual laps. Everyone completes the same number of laps, but you don't know how the fastest racers are doing because they're way ahead. You're just trying to get your best time.
And what's the difference between road motorbikes and racetrack motorbikes?
Racetrack motorbikes are superior. They're designed purely for racing and aren't available to buy. I'm unlikely to ever have a go on one. Anyone can get a road motorbike and adapt it for racing. Racetrack bikes feature sophisticated electronics and an impressive number of options for adjustments to the engine, and racers need to understand how to get the best from their bike. That takes practice. Road bikes are less complex, more straightforward to ride.
You operate as an individual, not as part of a team. How do you feel about that?
Well, whereas team racers are dependent on others to provide technical support, I have to know exactly what's going on with my bike. Some teams get tons of sponsorship, whereas individuals like me use their own resources. Entering the TT on your own doesn't come cheap, but that makes you committed to giving it your all.
But you've been part of a team in the past.
A couple. Though I wasn't a fan of switching between teams. It takes time to get the setup right. You form a close relationship with your team. You want to know each other well, and they need to know what you like about the bike so it can be built for you. You do that, then move and start again. I found that disrupted things, which can affect your chances of success.
Tell us about your mechanic.
That's my friend Phil. He's been helping me out for years, though he's shown little interest in getting on a bike himself. If I could pay him, I would. He'd certainly get a share of any winnings. I wouldn't go racing without him. He chases the dream with me, so any achievements are his too. Racers tend to get the credit when they win, but they couldn't do it without backup.
What's it like out on the TT course?
When you're familiarising yourself with the course before the races, you're memorising every bend, wall and building. By race day, you know every important detail. Races aren't the time to try new ways of doing things. When you're racing, you're not taking in the sights. The scenery is spectacular, apparently. At top speeds, you're dealing with wind resistance, bumps in the road. It's hardly a relaxing ride. Your focus is purely on what's coming next.
Have you been given lots of advice?
I used to hang about where teams were preparing bikes for races and find out what I could by asking them all kinds of stuff. There was this guy who'd give me tips. He wanted me to get things right. I learned to think things through thoroughly before acting, though I still get it wrong now and then. His advice has been invaluable.
Thanks, Matt.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear a teacher giving a talk about origami, the Japanese art of paper folding. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
The origins of origami or Japanese paper folding are difficult to establish, as original pieces of the art form have long since disappeared. Paper was introduced to Japan around the 6th century, and it's believed that Japan's tradition of folding paper began shortly after that. Paper was expensive to make, and for the next 1,000 years, paper folding was largely used in religious ceremonies. However, paper making was one of the industries that grew rapidly during the Edo period, between 1603 and 1868, making paper widely available in Japan and inspiring more informal uses of origami. One early example of origami was known as noshi, an arrow shape, which was a symbol of good fortune and which people gave as presents. The first known representative origami were butterfly shapes, used for decoration at weddings and representing the bride and groom. An independent tradition of paper folding developed in Europe in the 11th or 12th century, in Germany and Spain. This is thought to have come from the tradition of styling napkins. This was done before mealtimes, as displays for the table. Eventually, paper folding made its way into European schools, where it was used in math lessons to teach children about geometry. When the same kind of school system was adopted in Japan, it was German paper folding that was taught to young pupils. As a result, modern Japanese origami is a combination of Japanese and European traditions. The modern popularization of Japanese origami is largely due to an origami artist called Akira Yoshizawa. He is credited with tens of thousands of original designs and a new system which used dashed lines and dots to indicate different kinds of folds, known as mountains and valleys. In 1954, he published a book of his designs called New Origami Art, which became the standard of Japanese paper folding. Nowadays, origami typically uses a single sheet of paper to create representative shapes such as birds or flowers. Other techniques allow cutting or involve multiple sheets of paper. A technique called modular origami uses multiple shapes to create a larger construction, and what's known as wet folding allows the creation of shapes which are more circular. Action origami refers to toy-like origami such as jumping frogs. there is no single correct form, and people continue to pass down both long-standing designs and new creations as the art develops and adapts to modern interests.
Now you will hear the talk again.
The origins of origami, or Japanese paper folding, are difficult to establish, as original pieces of the art form have long since disappeared. Paper was introduced to Japan around the 6th century, and it's believed that Japan's tradition of folding paper began shortly after that. Paper was expensive to make, and for the next 1,000 years, paper folding was largely used in religious ceremonies. However, papermaking was one of the industries that grew rapidly during the Edo period, between 1603 and 1868, making paper widely available in Japan and inspiring more informal uses of origami. One early example of origami was known as noshi, an arrow shape, which was a symbol of good fortune and which people gave as presents. The first known representative origami were butterfly shapes, used for decoration at weddings and representing the bride and groom. An independent tradition of paper folding developed in Europe in the 11th or 12th century in Germany and Spain. This is thought to have come from the tradition of styling napkins. This was done before mealtimes as displays for the table. Eventually, paper folding made its way into European schools, where it was used in math lessons to teach children about geometry. When the same kind of school system was adopted in Japan, it was German paper folding that was taught to young pupils. As a result, modern Japanese origami is a combination of Japanese and European traditions. The modern popularization of Japanese origami is largely due to an origami artist called Akira Yoshizawa. He is credited with tens of thousands of original designs and a new system which used dashed lines and dots to indicate different kinds of folds, known as mountains and valleys. In 1954, he published a book of his designs called New Origami Art, which became the standard of Japanese paper folding. Nowadays, origami typically uses a single sheet of paper to create representative shapes such as birds or flowers. Other techniques allow cutting or involve multiple sheets of paper. A technique called modular origami uses multiple shapes to create a larger construction, and what's known as wet folding allows the creation of shapes which are more circular. Action origami refers to toy-like origami such as jumping frogs. There is no single correct form, and people continue to pass down both long-standing designs and new creations as the art develops and adapts to modern interests.
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about the benefits and uses of origami and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
I loved that talk about origami the other day. Are you planning on attending the origami workshop tomorrow?
Definitely. You?
Yeah. It actually sounds quite a fun way of learning about stuff. I've been doing a bit of reading since the talk, and apparently the concepts of origami are used in engineering too.
Yeah, I read something about that. Like, it helps designers come up with smart structures that stretch and bend, and products and devices that have really cool features.
By being able to fold up, do you mean?
Right. And origami can be used for all sorts of other things.
Yeah, it's used in hospitals and clinics too. You know, like in covers for complex things like X-ray equipment. The material these are made of remains hygienic, so they don't have to keep being replaced all the time. And it's used in a similar way in cars and for sports goods too. Like, there's this rucksack that stops things moving about and getting damaged inside it while you're running or whatever.
So it's great for portable stuff too. And being used more and more for creative solutions to things.
Yeah. Self-folding structures are really on the rise by the sounds of it. Eventually they could be made use of when exploring space too. It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. It's fascinating to look into the mechanics of folded structures and their underlying laws.
Anyway, we know from the talk that origami's used for various educational purposes.
Yeah, and I think the aim of tomorrow's workshop is to develop critical thinking. So not just accepting things without making sure they're sound ideas. As long as there's no problem solving involved, I'll be happy. I'm not the most imaginative person.
Well, if kids can learn origami, I suppose most people can.
But I guess it's something that some people will naturally be better at doing than others, you know, depending on the kind of personality they have.
Do you? What, like being able to demonstrate patience or creativity?
I was thinking of things like good coordination, actually, you know, between hand and eye.
Some origami is pretty simple, I think, but I know it can be really complex too. Anyway, it'll be a fun afternoon, whatever we end up doing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
I loved that talk about origami the other day. Are you planning on attending the origami workshop tomorrow?
Definitely. You?
Yeah. It actually sounds quite a fun way of learning about stuff. I've been doing a bit of reading since the talk, and apparently the concepts of origami are used in engineering too.
Yeah, I read something about that. Like, it helps designers come up with smart structures that stretch and bend, and products and devices that have really cool features.
By being able to fold up, do you mean?
Right. And origami can be used for all sorts of other things.
Yeah, it's used in hospitals and clinics too. You know, like in covers for complex things like X-ray equipment. The material these are made of remains hygienic, so they don't have to keep being replaced all the time. And it's used in a similar way in cars and for sports goods too. Like, there's this rucksack that stops things moving about and getting damaged inside it while you're running or whatever.
So it's great for portable stuff too. And being used more and more for creative solutions to things.
Yeah, self-folding structures are really on the rise by the sounds of it. Eventually they could be made use of when exploring space too. It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. It's fascinating to look into the mechanics of folded structures and their underlying laws.
Anyway, we know from the talk that origami's used for various educational purposes.
Yeah, and I think the aim of tomorrow's workshop is to develop critical thinking. So not just accepting things without making sure they're sound ideas. As long as there's no problem solving involved, I'll be happy. I'm not the most imaginative person.
Well, if kids can learn origami, I suppose most people can.
But I guess it's something that some people will naturally be better at doing than others, you know, depending on the kind of personality they have.
Do you? What, like being able to demonstrate patience or creativity?
I was thinking of things like good coordination, actually, you know, between hand and eye.
Some origami is pretty simple, I think. But I know it can be really complex too. Anyway, it'll be a fun afternoon, whatever we end up doing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
That is the end of Exercise 5, and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.